Imagine a ledger, right? But it's written entirely in blood.
Ooh, yeah. That's a strong visual.
Right. And it isn't like tucked away in some dusty accounting office somewhere. It is this massive ancient tome, and it's locked deep inside a mountain fortress.
Yeah.
And every single entry in this thing details a slight or a betrayal or, you know, a broken promise. And it is basically the ultimate symbol of why this specific world is dying.
It really is.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are immersing ourselves in a single lore essay today. It's titled Order and Destruction, a field guide to the factions of the old world.
Such a good read.
It is. And the mission today isn't just to like list off cool fantasy monsters. We're exploring what is honestly a masterclass in world building.
Absolutely.
Because the thesis we're exploring here, it basically flips the standard fantasy script completely on its head. The apocalypse that's looming over the setting isn't happening because the villains are overwhelmingly strong.
Right, which is the usual trope.
Exactly. It's happening because the good guys are fundamentally irreparably petty.
Yeah, the author of the essay frames the entire Warhammer fantasy universe as, well, basically a tragedy of a fragmented civilization.
Yeah.
It completely strips away that shiny veneer of epic fantasy,
Hey,
and it reveals this deeply human, deeply flawed engine that's just driving the whole narrative.
it's so grim when you really look at it.
Right. You have these ancient, incredibly powerful factions of so-called forces of order, and they possess all the necessary resources, the technology, the magic, everything they need to permanently secure their world.
But they don't.
No, they consistently choose not to. It's like they are a highly defensible society
Right.
that is actively choosing annihilation just because they cannot let go of their pride.
Okay, let's unpack this because to really understand the mechanics of this dysfunction, you have to look closely at that bloody ledger I mentioned.
Yes, the dwarfs.
Right, the dwarves or the Dawi, they call it the Domaz Cran, the Great Book of Grudges. And, you know, as readers of fantasy lore, we know dwarves hold grudges. It's like a total staple of the setting.
It's basically their defining personality trait.
Exactly. But this essay elevates it from a fun fantasy trope to this suffocating cultural mandate. A grudge isn't just a feeling for them, it is a tangible debt.
It is the anchor of their entire legal and moral framework.
Yeah.
When a slight is actually recorded in the Demos Kron, nothing, and I mean nothing, is forgiven until proportionate vengeance is taken.
Even if it takes like thousands of years.
Regardless of the centuries that pass or the strategic cost. The text really highlights how this traps the dwarfs in what their own histories literally call the Time of Woes.
Which is such a depressing name for an era.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Their underground holds, the Kerax, they're constantly falling to earthquakes and subterranean invasions.
Right.
But instead of adapting their society or maybe, I don't know, seeking permanent alliances with other races, they just calcify. Their response to decline is absolute grim stubbornness.
And that calcification, it creates some truly tragic sociological stuff, like the
Oh,
Slayers.
the Slayers, yeah.
We know Slayers are these shamed dwarf warriors, right? They dye their hair into these massive orange crests, they abandon all their possessions, and they basically just go out seeking a monster big enough to kill them honorably to wipe their slate clean.
Yeah.
But reading this essay's analysis, you realize, wait, this isn't just about bravery.
No, not at all.
It's a symptom of a society where the whole concept of honor has become utterly fatal.
Exactly.
Like when an infrastructure fails or a battle is lost, instead of rebuilding or, you know, learning from the failure, the society's most capable veterans essentially commit elaborate, honorable suicide.
What's fascinating here is how Warhammer rarely lets you admire a hero or a society without immediately exposing its grim cost.
Always a catch.
Always. The Slayers represent a massive brain drain and muscle drain on an empire that is actively dying. And that same institutional stubbornness, it inevitably infected the human realms they helped establish, too.
Oh, specifically the Empire of Man, because the Empire was forged through this foundational alliance with the dwarves. Sigmar Heldenhammer, the state god, he united the human tribes, allied with the dwarf High King, and he was gifted the Warhammer Galmaraz.
And the 12 Runefangs, yeah?
Right, the Runefangs.
Yeah.
But then you look at the Empire today, currently under the rule of Karl France, and it is a far cry from that unified ideal.
It's a mess.
It's a total mess. The text describes the Elector Counts operating less like a cohesive government and more like a highly dysfunctional homeowners association
as the perfect analogy.
that suddenly got access to Renaissance-era canon.
It's terrifying.
Right. Like, think about it. You have these brilliant engineers and these brave state troops, but their geopolitical strategy is constantly derailed. Why? Because two neighboring provinces are totally willing to burn their own farmlands over a century-old border dispute. They are forever one bad winter away from total collapse because they literally cannot stop arguing.
That internal friction is it's basically the defining feature of the empire. I mean, they have the pragmatism of gunpowder and steel, but they entirely lack a unity of purpose.
Exactly.
And then the author contrasts that with their neighbor to the west, Britonia.
Oh boy, Britonia.
Right. If the empire is defined by industrial pragmatism that's choked by petty politics, Britonia is defined by aesthetic purity that's masking just horrific cruelty.
It's the chivalric fairy tale on the surface. You have the Grail Knights, the Lady of the Lake, the gleaming armor, all of that.
Very Arthurian.
Very. But the author pulls back the curtain on the actual mechanics of Bretonian society, and it is a brutal feudal system.
Yeah, it's dark.
The serfs aren't just poor, they are systematically starved and taxed into the mud just so this tiny aristocracy can maintain the aesthetic of nobility. The serfs do all the dying, and the knights do all the questing.
Which is incredibly inefficient.
Right. Which makes me wonder, if Bretonnia relies on oppressing its own people just to function, and the empire is basically a vickering HOA, why does the lore even classify them as the forces of order?
Well, because in this universe, order does not equate to good.
Okay, that's an important distinction.
It really is. Order simply means civilization, stasis, and the preservation of the physical world. It is the direct opposite of chaos, which is dissolution.
Just unmaking reality.
Exactly. Britonnia and the Empire want the world to continue existing, even if their methods for maintaining it are fundamentally unjust or just highly inefficient.
Okay, that makes sense. But if humanity and the dwarfs are failing this badly at the ground level, you'd assume the magical advanced races like the elves would be the adults in the room, right? Holding the macro structure together.
You would hope so.
You would. But instead, the essay paints their entire 2,500-year history as just a catastrophic soap opera.
It really is a soap opera.
Let's look at the high elves, the Asur, over on Ulthuan. They are supposedly maintaining the Great Vortex. And the text describes this vortex as basically the most vital piece of infrastructure on the planet.
Oh, absolutely. It functions like a planetary drain.
The drain.
Yeah, it creates this massive magical pressure differential that actively siphons raw chaos energy straight out of reality.
Wow.
If the vortex collapses, the world literally drowns in demons. So the High Elves are shouldering this apocalyptic burden, but the psychological toll is just immense.
I can imagine.
The author argues that maintaining this mechanism that nobody else even understands, let alone thanks them for, has bred this deep isolationist arrogance.
Right.
They view every other race as children because, from their perspective, they are the only ones keeping the sky from falling.
And then their cousins, the Wood Elves of Athel Lorien, the Azrai, they took that isolationism and completely weaponized it.
Oh, yeah. They don't care about the rest of the world.
Not at all. They don't want to save the world. They just want everyone to leave their sentient forest alone. We know their leader, Orion, burns to death every midwinter and is reborn in the spring alongside Ariel.
Such a cool piece of lore.
It is, but the essay focuses on the startling violence they will commit just to protect their trees. It's lethal apathy.
Yep.
But neither of those compare to the sheer scale of the grudges that permanently broke the elven and dwarven superpowers. Here's where it gets really interesting. The War of Vengeance.
Or, as the dwarves call it, the War of the Beard.
Okay, I have to push back on the premise here, though. As an analyst looking at this world building, are we really supposed to believe that two ancient, highly advanced superpowers permanently crippled each other over an elven insult and a shaved dwarf beard?
I know it sounds ridiculous.
Right. Surely, a civilization that can manipulate the magical poles of the planet had, I don't know, underlying economic tensions or territorial disputes. And the beard was just the match in the powder keg. It feels absurd to attribute a world-ending war purely to an insult.
It sounds absurd to a modern pragmatic mind, yes. But the essay argues that projecting our real-world geopolitical logic onto them completely misses the core thesis of the setting.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In Warhammer, pride is the prime mover. Now, the lore heavily implies that dark elf agents, the Druki, orchestrated the initial provocations with false flags.
Okay, so there was some manipulation.
There was, but the tragedy is that the war happened anyway, because neither culture possessed the diplomatic humility to de-escalate.
Wow.
The high elven arrogance couldn't fathom apologizing to what they saw as lesser beings. And the dwarven cultural mandate of the Damaz Kron demanded blood for a physical mutilation like shaving a beard.
They literally couldn't stop themselves.
Exactly. The escalation was driven entirely by ego, culminating in Dwarf High King Gotrek's Starbreaker, literally killing Phoenix King Kalidor II in single combat. They ground each other to dust because their cultures just lacked a mechanism for forgiveness.
They literally chose to lose the future because they couldn't let go of the past. And the elves didn't just break their alliance with the dwarves, they broke themselves too, the sundering.
The Great Civil War.
Right. We all know the broad strokes Anarion draws the cursed sword of Cain, saves the world, but dooms his bloodline. His son, Malekith, is passed over for the throne, tries to walk through the sacred flame of Asurion to prove his divine right, and gets horribly burned.
Just completely charred.
But the essay's sociological take on what happens next is wild.
It is, because Malekith survives, sings half his own homeland, and flees to the freezing northern continent of Naggaroth with his mother Maranthi.
To establish the Dark Elves.
Oh, were they drinky?
And you look at Druchi society, it's an economy utterly dependent on slavery, a culture built around the worship of Cain, the god of murder. And why? Because they live in a frozen wasteland and refuse to admit they lost a civil war.
Yeah.
You have a sprawling civilization whose entire existence, their foreign policies, their economic structure, it's all fundamentally built on one rejected heir's metastasized temper tantrum.
A 2,500-year temper tantrum.
Exactly. It is grievance elevated to a state religion.
Exactly. When your foundational myth is that the universe wrongs your god, King, cruelty becomes a virtue. It justifies every single atrocity they commit.
So with the forces of order hopelessly bogged down by their own pride and grudges, what exactly is the math of the threat waiting outside the door? The essay pivots here to the forces of destruction.
And it doesn't just list the monsters.
Right.
It actually explains the mechanisms of why they are so insurmountable, starting with chaos.
Or big bets.
Yeah. The four gods, Khorne, Nurgle, Tsinch, and Slaanesh, playing the great game. But it's not just like a generic evil army. They are the literal metaphysics of the setting pouring through collapsed polar gateways.
They are the dark reflections of mortal emotions.
Yes, and the text points out the exquisite irony of Slaanesh in particular. Slaanesh was birthed from elven excess.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so the god has a specific insatiable hunger for elven souls. So the elves, in all their arrogance, they're forced to wear magical talismans constantly.
Just to survive.
Because the metaphysical consequence of their own past decadence is actively trying to consume them right now.
It's literally the past hunting them.
Yeah.
Then you have the greenskins, the orcs and goblins. The biological engine of this faction is just terrifying. They aren't just a horde of angry warriors, they are fungal creatures.
Which is such a wild concept.
They reproduce by spores.
Which means the very act of fighting them ensures their continuation. When you strike down an orc on the battlefield, the spores released from its body essentially fertilize the soil for the next generation.
That's horrifying.
You cannot win a war of attrition against an enemy that uses its own casualties as seeds.
And the text explains the psychic phenomenon of the Wa, too. When they gather in large enough numbers, worshiping their twin gods, Gork and Mork, their collective bloodlust generates this localized psychic field.
It alters reality.
It does. If enough greenskins believe a pile of scrap metal is a functioning war machine, the psychic energy of the Wa makes it function. It's literally belief creating physics on the battlefield.
It is a brilliant inversion of Order's rigid magic. Order relies on ancient, decaying infrastructure like the Vortex. Destruction, via the Greenskins, relies on chaotic, spontaneous belief that literally bends the rules of the universe.
And speaking of bending the rules of the universe, let's look at the undead, invented by Nagash through the refinement of Warpstone into an elixir of immortality.
Nagash, the great necromancer.
Right. But my absolute favorite detail in the entire lore, and the essay dedicates a great section to this, is the Tomb Kings of Nakara. Nagash botches his grand ritual to raise an entire civilization of the dead as his mindless slaves.
He succeeds in waking them, but he completely fails to subjugate them.
They wake up with their personalities and their fury completely intact. You have these ancient dynasts looking around at their ruined, mummified bodies, and instead of despairing, their egos simply override death.
It's amazing.
The text quotes their greatest leader, Setra the Imperishable. Nagash demands his servitude, and Setra replies, "Setra does not serve. Setra rules."
So I cut.
It is the ultimate triumph of ego. Even within the forces of destruction, there is zero unity. Setra will fight the living, but he will fight the creator of necromancy just as fiercely because he just refuses to bow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really proves the author's point that pride is the universal constant here. Setra's pride mirrors the dwarf's grudges or the elves' arrogance.
Right.
It's just wrapped in bandages rather than armor.
But out of all these nightmares, the essay argues the most acute threat is actually the Skaven, the Under-Empire.
Oh, the Ratman.
Millions of subterranean ratmen wielding technology powered by warpstone. And the text does a great job explaining what warpstone actually is. It's not just a glowing green rock. It is raw, solidified chaos magic.
It is the literal essence of mutation.
Yeah.
Which explains the absolute insanity of Skaven engineering. Clans like Skryer are building snipers and, like, nuclear-adjacent doom wheels out of solidified chaos.
Just casual nuclear rat tech.
Right. They are bypassing conventional physics to create apocalyptic weaponry. But because the fuel source is inherently mutative and unstable, the weapons are just as likely to annihilate the user as the enemy.
But mathematically, they have the numbers and the tech to overrun the surface world tomorrow. Yet they are governed by the Council of 13, and their entire society is built on backstabbing.
Constant betrayal.
A Skaven leader spends 90% of their energy ensuring their lieutenants don't assassinate them, leaving only 10% to fight humanity. They are their own great filter.
Thankfully for everyone else.
Right, but the detail I really want to drill down into is the Empire's official response to the Skaven. The Empire officially denies they even exist.
Yes, the state policy is that the Skaven are merely a myth, a peasant superstition.
Think about how we process information in conspiracies today, you know? This is a modern conspiracy theory in reverse.
It really is.
Imagine you are a citizen of the Empire, and there is a verifiable, world-ending civilization of ratmen tunneling under your subway system, actively undermining the foundations of your cities.
And your government's official stance is to gaslight you into believing you're crazy for seeing them.
Why on earth would the elector counts mandate that level of denial?
Because the truth is societally fatal.
Really?
Yeah. If the citizenry of the Empire truly understood the scale of the Under-Empire, that an unstoppable tide of millions of ratmen was waiting just beneath their floorboards, society would instantly collapse into panic.
I mean, I would panic.
Right. The infrastructure would grind to a halt. Denial, in this context, is a deeply flawed but entirely necessary survival mechanism.
Wow.
It allows the elector counts to keep the population focused on paying taxes and fighting border skirmishes rather than succumbing to the existential terror beneath them.
It is institutionalized ignorance masquerading as stability. That is wild.
Brilliantly dark.
So, with the center failing this badly, what about the outliers? The final pieces on the board. The essay looks at Kislev in the north, the Russia-flavored kingdom with winged lancers and ice witches.
Oh, Kislev.
Their tragedy isn't internal politics, it's geography. They are the meat shield. They take the absolute brunt of every chaos incursion pouring out of the north, bleeding themselves dry just to buy the empire the time it needs to muster its armies.
Kislev suffers so the empire can debate.
Perfectly put. And then, at the far end of the spectrum, you have the oldest faction in the setting, the Lizardmen, operating out of the jungle continent of Lestria.
And their societal mechanism is entirely alien to everything else we've talked about.
Right. They serve the old ones, these vanished cosmic architects who terraform the planet. The Lizardmen are commanded by the Slan, these immense psychic toad priests who spend centuries in meditative trances.
Just trying to interpret a cosmic blueprint left behind by the old ones called the Great Plan.
And beneath the Slan is a strictly biological, caste-based society. Saurus are bred only for war, Skinks for administration, Croxigurs for labor.
What the essay makes clear is that the Lizardmen do not operate on a spectrum of human morality.
Not at all.
They aren't fighting chaos because they value life or kindness. They are fighting chaos because it violates the geometric perfection of the Great Plan.
Yeah.
If a human settlement happens to be built on a line that intersects a planned jungle temple, the Lizardmen will march out and massacre the entire city without a single second of malice.
They are simply enforcing a cosmic design manual.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? The essay lays out the final arithmetic of the setting. You have the Great Vortex actively draining chaos magic. You have the Slan psychically steering historical events.
You have the Empire's vast industrial capacity and gunpowder.
Britonia has devastating heavy cavalry. The dwarfs possess unmatched defensive engineering. The elves wield world-shaping magic. And Kislev is holding the northern choke point.
If you just look at the math, Order has the strategic assets to definitively win the great game.
The math heavily favors survival. If these factions just shared intelligence, combined their arcane and industrial technologies, and coordinated their borders, chaos would find itself starving for entry points.
But they absolutely won't do it.
No, never.
This raises an important question, doesn't it? How do we overcome our own nature? The source material demonstrates that intelligence and technology are completely useless if the culture wielding them is broken.
Yeah.
The dwarves will never forgive the High Elves. The High Elves and Dark Elves are locked in a zero-sum war of extinction.
The Empire would rather litigate border taxes than share gunpowder with Britonia.
Exactly. The Wood Elves will shoot anyone who enters their trees. And the Lizardmen are enforcing a grand strategy that literally no one else is allowed to read.
Every single faction has its own version of the Demascron, its own ledger of grievances written in blood or passed down in trauma. And every time they prioritize settling a past grudge over securing a future alliance, they leave the door unguarded.
It is a brilliant piece of world building because it forces you to look at our own information silos.
Right. It's an exaggerated, magical mirror for humanity's struggle with political polarization and just the inability to let go of historical wrongs to address global existential threats.
We constantly see those exact fault lines in our own history. The setting works not because the monsters are scary, but because the heroes are painfully, recognizably human in their failures.
It's so true. But before we wrap up this deep dive, there is one final lingering tease hidden in the text that completely upends everything we've talked about regarding the elves.
Oh, this part is so good.
The author hints that Malekith, the horribly burned Witch King, the architect of the Dark Elves whose temper tantrums split the civilization thousands of years ago, has a storyline that pays off during the end times apocalypse. And the text calls it the single best twist in the whole saga.
It completely recontextualizes the foundational myth of their entire tragic civil war.
Exactly. So I want you to ponder this as we close. What could possibly be the ultimate fate of a 2,500-year-old exiled villain that would completely rewrite the greatest grudge in the history of this dying world? We know the sacred flame of Assyrian burned him all those millennia ago when he tried to claim the throne. But what if the flames weren't trying to reject him?
Oh, that gives me chills.
What if, in a world defined by the tragedy of misunderstood magic and blind pride, history simply got the reason wrong? What if the flames were trying to temper him?
It is a fascinating puzzle that challenges the reliability of the lore itself.
It really does. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the old world. Next time you feel like holding on to a petty grievance, just remember that ledger is written in blood, and closing the book might be the only way to save the world.